Site 5, Imperial Earth, beginning on page 200. Especially as such chicanery was always discovered, sooner or later, smugglers could never resist displaying their treasures. And then there would be another acquisition for the impecunious Titan Museum, while the criminal would be barred from all the best places for at least a month. No, Armand could be excluded, but what of his son? The more Duncan considered this possibility, the more likely it seemed. He had no proof whatsoever, only an array of facts all pointing in one direction. Consider. Carl had always been daring and adventurous, willing to run risks for what he believed sufficiently good reasons. As a boy, he had taken a positive delight in circumventing regulations, except, of course, those basic safety rules that no sane resident of Titan would ever challenge. If Titanite had been discovered on one of the other satellites, Carl would be in an excellent position to take advantage of it. In the last 3 years, he had been on half a dozen Titan-Terran surveys. To Duncan's certain knowledge, he was one of the few men who had been to Enceladus, Tethys, Dione, Rhea, Hyperion, Iapetus, Phoebe, Cronus, Prometheus. And now he was on remote Mnemosyne. Already Duncan could draw up a seductively plausible scenario. Carl might even have made the find himself. Certainly he would have seen all the specimens coming aboard the survey ship, and his well-known charm would have done the rest. Indeed, the actual discoverer might never have known what he had found. Few people had seen raw titanite, and it was not easy to identify until it had been polished. Then it would have been a simple matter of sending a small package to Earth, perhaps on one of the resupply ships which did not even call it Titan. What would be the legal situation then? That could be tricky. Titan had jurisdiction over the other permanent satellites, but its claim to the obvious temporary ones, like Phoebe and Company, was still in dispute. It was possible that no laws had been broken at all. But this was sheer speculation. He had not the slightest hard evidence. Why, indeed, had he thought of Carl at all in this context? He reread the message, still glowing on the console monitor. Major discovery on outer moon, asking Helmer. That was what had triggered this line of thought, guilt by association, perhaps. The juxtaposition might be pure coincidence. But the Mackenzies could read each other's minds, and Duncan knew that the phraseology was deliberate. There was no need for Colin to have mentioned Helmer. He was sending out an early warning signal. It was ridiculous to pile speculation upon speculation, but Duncan could not resist the next step. Assuming that Carl was involved, why? Carl might take risks, might even get involved in petty illegalities, but it would be for some good purpose. If, and it was still an enormous if, he was trying to accumulate funds on Earth, he must have a long-range objective in mind. The most obvious was the establishment of a power base, precisely as Duncan was doing. He must also have an agent here, someone he could trust implicitly. That would not be difficult. Carl had met hundreds of Terrans. Oh, my God, Duncan breathed. That explains everything. He wondered if he should cancel his trip to Zanzibar. No, that took priority over all else, except the speech he had come a billion kilometers to deliver. In any case, he did not see what more he could do here in Washington until he had further news from home. He was still operating on pure guesswork, without one atom of proof. But there was a cold, dead feeling in the general region of his heart. And suddenly, for no good reason at all, Duncan thought of that solitary iceberg, gliding southward on the hidden current towards its irrevocable destiny. Chapter 31, The Island of Dr. Mohammed. El-Hajj's deputy, Dr. Todd, was one of those medical men who seemed not always justifiably to radiate an aura of confidence. This despite his relative youth and informality. For reasons which Duncan never discovered, all his colleagues used his nickname, Sweeney. "I'm sorry you won't meet El-Hajj this time," he said apologetically. "He had to rush to Hawaii for an emergency operation." "I'm surprised that's necessary in this age." "Normally it's not. But Hawaii is almost exactly on the other side of the world, which means you have to work through 2 commsats in series. During telesurgery, that extra time delay can be critical." So even on Earth, thought Duncan, the slowness of radio waves can be a problem. A half-second lag would not matter in conversation, but between a surgeon's hand and eye, it might be fatal. Until 20 years ago, Dr. Todd explained, this was a famous marine biology lab, so it had most of the facilities we need, including isolation. "Why is that necessary?" asked Duncan. He had wondered why the clinic was in such an inconveniently out-of-the-way spot. "There's a good deal of emotional interest in our work, and we have to control visitors. Despite air transportation, you can still do that much easier on an island than anywhere else. And above all, we have to protect our mothers. They may not be very intelligent, but they're sensitive and don't like being stared at. I've not seen any yet. Do you really want to? That was a difficult question to answer, for Duncan felt his emotions tugging in opposite directions. 31 years ago, he must have been born in a place not unlike this, though probably not as spectacularly beautiful. If he had gone full term, and in those days he assumed all clones did so, some unknown woman had carried him in her body for at least 8 months after implantation. Was she still alive? Did any record of her name still exist? Or was she merely a number in a computer file? Perhaps not even that, for the identity of a foster mother was not of the slightest biological importance. A purely mechanical womb could have served as well, but there had never been any real need to perfect so complex a device. In a world where reproduction was strictly limited, there would always be plenty of volunteers. The only problem was selecting them. Duncan had no memory whatsoever of his unknown foster mother, or of the months he must have spent on Earth as a baby. Every attempt to penetrate the fog that lay at the very beginning of his childhood was a failure. He could not be certain if this was normal, or whether the earliest part of his life was hidden by deliberately induced amnesia. He suspected the latter, since he felt a distinct reluctance ever to investigate the subject in any detail. When he formed the concept mother in his mind, he instantly saw Colin's wife, Sheila. Her face was his earliest memory, her affection his first love, later shared with Grandma Ellen. Colin had chosen carefully and had learned from Malcolm's mistakes. Sheila had treated Duncan exactly like her own children, and he had never thought of Uri and Glynn as anything except his older brother and sister. He could not remember when he had first realized that Colin was not their father, and that they bore no genetic relationship to him whatsoever. Somehow it had never seemed to matter. He appreciated now the unobtrusive skills that had gone into the creation of so well-adjusted a family. It would not have been possible in an earlier age of exclusive marriage and sexual possessiveness. Even today it was no easy task. He hoped that he and Marissa would be equally successful, and that Clyde and Carlene would accept little Malcolm as their brother, just as wholeheartedly as Uri and Glenn had once accepted him. "I'm sorry," said Duncan. "I was daydreaming." "Can't say I blame you. This place is too damned beautiful. I sometimes have to draw the curtains when I want to do any work." This was easy to believe. Yet beauty was not the first impression to strike Duncan when he landed on the island. Even now, his dominant feeling was one of awe, mixed with more than a trace of fear. Starting a dozen meters away, and filling his field of vision right out to the sharp blue line of the horizon, was more water than he had ever imagined. It was true that he had seen Earth's oceans from space, but from that Olympian vantage point, it had been impossible to envisage their true size. Even the greatest of seas was diminished when one could flash across it in 10 minutes. This world was indeed misnamed. It should have been called Ocean, not Earth. Duncan performed a rough mental calculation, one of the skills the Mackenzies had carefully retained, despite the omnipresent computer. Radius 6,000, and his eye was about 6 meters above sea level. That made it simple. 6 root 2, or near enough 8 kilometers. Only 8. It was incredible. He could easily have believed that the horizon was 100 kilometers away. His vision could not span even 1% of the distance to the other shore. And what he could see now was only the two-dimensional skin of an alien universe, teeming with strange life forms seeking whom they might devour. To Duncan, that expanse of peaceful blue concealed a world much more hostile and more terrifying than space. Even Titan, with its known dangers, seemed benign in comparison. And yet there were children out there, splashing around in the shallows and disappearing underwater for quite terrifying lengths of time. One of them, Duncan was certain, had been gone for well over a minute. "Isn't that dangerous?" he asked anxiously, gesturing toward the lagoon. "We don't let them go near the water until they're well trained. And if you must drown yourself, this is the place for it, with some of the best medical facilities in the world. We've had only one permanent death in the last 15 years. Revival would have been possible even then, but after an hour underwater, brain damage is irreversible. But what about sharks and all the other big fish? We've never had an attack inside the reef, and only one outside it. That's a small price to pay for admission to Fairyland. We're taking out the big trimaran tomorrow. Why don't you come along?" "I'll think about it," Duncan answered evasively. "Oh, I suppose you've never been underwater before." "I've never been on it, except in a swimming pool." "Well, you've nothing to lose. Though we won't complete the tests for another 48 hours, I'm sure we'll be able to clone successfully from the genotypes you've given. So your immortality insurance is taken care of." "Thank you very much," said Duncan dryly. "That makes all the difference. He remembered Commander Innes's invitation to the Caribbean reefs, and his instant, though unexpressed, refusal. But those mere children were obviously enjoying themselves, and their confidence was a reproach to his manhood. The pride of the Mackenzies was at stake. He looked glumly at that appalling mass of water and realized that he would have to do something about it before he left the island. He had never felt less enthusiastic about any project in his life. The night was beautiful, blazing with more stars than any man could ever see from the surface of Titan, however long he lived. Though it was only 1900 hours, too early for dinner, let alone sleep, the sun might never have existed. So total was the darkness away from the illumination of the main buildings and of the little lights strung along the paths of crushed coral. From somewhere in that darkness came the sound of music, a rhythmical throbbing of drums played with more enthusiasm than skill. Rising above the steady beat were occasional bursts of song and women's voices calling to one another. Those voices made Duncan suddenly lonely and homesick. He started to walk along the narrow path in the general direction of the revelry. After wandering down several blind alleys, ending up once in a charming sunken garden, which he left with profuse apologies to the couple busily occupying it, he came to the clearing where the party was in progress. At its center, a large bonfire was lofting a column of smoke and flames toward the stars, and a score of figures was dancing around it, like the priestesses of some primitive religion. They were not dancing with much grace or vigor. In fact, it would be more truthful to say that most of them were circulating in a dignified waddle. But despite their obvious advanced state of pregnancy, they were clearly enjoying themselves and were being as active as was advisable in the circumstances. It was a grotesque yet strangely moving spectacle, arousing in Duncan a mixture of pity and tenderness, even an impersonal and wholly unerotic love. The tenderness was that which all men feel in the imminent presence of birth and the wonder of their own existence. The pity had a different cause. Ugliness and deformity were rare on Titan, and rarer still on Earth, since both could almost always be corrected. Almost, but not always. Here was proof of that. Most of these women were extremely plain. Some were ugly. A few were frankly hideous. And though Duncan noticed two or three who might even pass as beautiful, it needed only a glance to show that they were mentally subnormal. Had his long-dead sister, Anitra, survived into adult life, she would have been at home in this strange assembly. If the dancers, and those others merely sitting around, banging away at drums and sawing on fiddles, had not been so obviously happy, it would have been a disturbing, perhaps even a sickening spectacle. It did not upset Duncan. Though he was startled, he was prepared for it. He knew how the foster mothers were chosen. The first requirement, of course, was that they should have no gynecological defects. That demand was easy to satisfy. It was not so simple to cope with the psychological factors, and it might have been a virtually impossible task in the days before the world's population was computer-profiled. There would always be women who desperately yearned to bear children, but who, for one reason or another, could not fulfill their destiny. In early ages, most of them would have been doomed to spinsterly frustration. Indeed, even in this world of 2276, many of them still were. There were more would-be mothers than the controlled birth rate could satisfy. But those who were especially disadvantaged could find some compensation here. The losers in the lottery of fate could yet win a consolation prize and know for a few months the happiness that would otherwise be denied them. And so the world computer had been programmed as an instrument of compassion. This act of humanity had done more than anything else to silence those who objected to cloning. Of course, there were still problems, and all these mothers must know, however dimly, that soon after birth they would be separated forever from the child they were to bring into the world. That was not a sorrow that any man could understand. But women were stronger than men, and they would get over it, more often than not by taking part again in the creation of another life. Duncan remained in the shadows, not wishing to be seen, and certainly not wishing to get involved. Some of those incipient mothers could crush him to a pulp if they grabbed him and whirled him into the dance. He had now noticed that a handful of men, presumably medical orderlies or staff from the clinic, were circulating lightheartedly with the mothers and entering into the spirit of the festivities. He could not help wondering if there had also been some deliberate psychological selection here. Several of the men looked very effeminate and were treating their partners with what could only be called sisterly affection. They were obviously dear friends, and that was all they would ever be. No one could have seen in the darkness Duncan's smile of amused recollection. He had just remembered, for the first time in years, a boy who had fallen in love with him in his late teens. It is hard to reject anyone who is devoted to you, but although Duncan had good-naturedly succumbed a few times to Nicky's blandishments, he had eventually managed to discourage his admirer, despite torrents of tears. Pity is not a good basis for any relationship, and Duncan could never feel quite happy with someone whose affections were exclusively polarized toward one sex. What a contrast to the aggressive normality of Carl, who did not give a damn whether he had more affairs with boys or girls or vice versa, at least until the Kalindi episode. These memories, so unexpectedly dredged up from the past, made Duncan aware of the complicated emotional cross-currents that must be sweeping through this place. And he suddenly recalled that disturbing conversation, or rather monologue, with Sir Mortimer Cain's. That he would follow in the steps of Colin and of Malcolm before was something that Duncan had always taken for granted, without any discussion. But now he realized, rather late in the day, that there was a price for everything, and that it should be considered very carefully before the contract was finally signed. Cloning was neither good nor bad, only its purpose was important. And that purpose should not be one that was trivial or selfish. Chapter 32. The Golden Reef. The vivid green band of palms and the brilliant white crescent of the perfect beach were now more than a kilometer away, on the far side of the barrier reef. Even through the dark glasses, which he dared not remove for a moment, the scene was almost painfully bright. When he looked in the direction of the sun and caught its sparkle off the ocean swell, Duncan was completely blinded. Though this was a trifling matter, it enhanced his feeling of separation from all his companions. True, most of them also wore dark glasses, but in their case it was a convenience, not a necessity. Despite his wholly terrestrial genes, it seemed that he had adapted irrevocably to the light of a world 10 times farther from the sun. Beneath the smoothly sliding flanks of the triple hull, the water was so clear that it added to Duncan's feeling of insecurity. The boat seemed to be hanging in midair with no apparent means of support, over a dappled seabed 5 or 10 meters below. It seemed strange that this should worry him, when he had looked down on Earth from orbit hundreds of kilometers above the atmosphere. He was startled by a sudden distant crash, altogether out of place on this idyllically peaceful morning. It came from somewhere out at sea, and Duncan spun around just in time to see a column of spray slowly falling back into the water. Surely no one would be allowed to set off submarine explosions in this area. Now there was a jet of vapor, which rose slanting from the sea, hung for a moment in the bright sunlight, and gradually dispersed. For a full minute, nothing else happened, and then Duncan was paralyzed with astonishment. With unbelievable slowness, but with the inevitability of some continent rising from the primordial depths, a vast gray shape was soaring out of the sea. There was a flash of white as monstrous flukes slammed against the waves and created another cloud of spray. And still that incredible bulk continued to climb as if defying gravity, until it was completely clear of the water, and hung poised for a moment above the blue ledge of the horizon. Then, still in slow motion, as if reluctant to leave an alien element, it fell back into the ocean and vanished beneath a final geyser of spray. The booming crash seemed to come ages later. Duncan had never imagined such a spectacle, but he had no need of any explanation. Moby Dick was one of the thousands of Terran classics he knew only through repute, but now he understood how Herman Melville must have felt when, for the first time, he saw the sea furrowed by a glistening back as large as an overturned ship, and conceived in the image of the white whale a symbol of the forces that lie behind the universe. He waited for many minutes, but the giant did not leap again, though from time to time there were brief spouts of vapor becoming more and more distant until they vanished from sight. "Why did it do that?" he asked Dr. Todd, his voice still hushed by the lingering aura of departed majesty. "Nobody really knows. It may be pure joie de vivre. It may be to impress a lady friend, or it may be merely to get rid of parasites. Whales are badly infested with barnacles and lampreys." How utterly incongruous, thought Duncan. It seemed almost an outrage that a god should be afflicted with lice. Now the trimaran was slowing down, and the sheer strangeness and beauty of the underwater scene captured his attention so completely that Duncan forgot his remoteness from land. The fantastic shapes of the corals and the colors of the fish that sported or sauntered among them were a revelation. He had already been astounded by the variety of life on land. Now he saw that it was far exceeded by the reckless profusion of the sea. Something like an antique jet plane went flapping slowly past, with graceful undulations of its spotted wings. None of the other fish took any notice. To Duncan's surprise, there was no sign of the carnage he had expected to witness in this realm where everything fed on everything else. In fact, it was hard to imagine a more peaceful scene. The few fish that had been chasing others were obviously doing so merely to protect their territory. The impression he had gathered from books and films had been almost wholly misleading. Cooperation, not competition, seemed to rule the reef. The trimaran came to a halt. The anchor was thrown out and was followed almost instantly by three rubber dinghies, four doctors, five nurses, and a mass of diving equipment. The scene appeared to Duncan to be one of utter confusion. Actually, it was much better planned and disciplined than he realized. The swimmers promptly divided into groups of three, and each trio went off with one of the dinghies, heading in a purposeful manner toward spots that had been obviously chosen in advance. If it's so safe, remarked Duncan after the last splashings had died away, why are they all carrying knives and those vicious-looking little spears? The trimaran was now almost deserted, its only other occupants besides Duncan being the skipper, who had promptly fallen asleep in front of the wheel, the engineer, who had disappeared below deck, and Dr. Todd. Those aren't weapons, they're gardening tools. You must have rather ferocious weeds. I wouldn't care to meet them. Oh, said Todd. Some of them put up a good fight. Why don't you go and have a look? You'll be sorry if you miss the chance. That was perfectly true, yet Duncan still hesitated. The water in which the trimaran was gently rocking was very shallow. Indeed, it appeared no deeper than the swimming pool at the Centennial Hotel. I'll go in with you. You can stand on the diving ladder until you get the hang of the face mask. And snorkel breathing should be easy to anyone who's used to a spacesuit. Duncan did not volunteer the information that he had never worn a genuine spacesuit. Nevertheless, a Titan surface life support system should be good training. And anyway, what could go wrong in a couple of meters of water? Why, there were places here where he could stand with his head above the surface. Sweeney Todd was right. He would never forgive himself if he turned down this opportunity of a lifetime. 10 minutes later, he was splashing inexpertly but steadily along the surface. Although it had seemed astonishing, and even indecent, to put on clothing when one entered the water, Todd had insisted that he dress from head to foot in a light one-piece overall of some closely knit fabric. It scarcely affected his movements, but he wished he could do without it. Some of these corals sting, the doctor had explained. It could spoil your day if you backed into one, and you might have an allergic reaction. Anything else you can think of? No, that's about it. Just watch me and hang on to the rubber dinghy whenever you want to rest. He was now rapidly gaining confidence and beginning to enjoy himself thoroughly. There was obviously no danger whatsoever while he drifted along behind the dinghy, never letting go of the rope dangling in the water. And Dr. Todd, he was reassured to observe, always kept within arm's length. He was being almost ridiculously overcautious. Even if a shark came shooting up out of the depths, Duncan believed he could be aboard the dinghy in 2 seconds flat, notwithstanding Earth's gravity. Now that he had mastered the use of the snorkel tube, he kept his head underwater all the time, and even essayed shallow dives, which involved holding his breath for considerable periods. The panorama beneath was so fascinating that Duncan even occasionally forgot the need for air and emerged sputtering foolishly. The first signboard was at a depth of 5 meters and said in fluorescent yellow letters, "No unauthorized visitors beyond this point." The second warning was a flashing holographic display in midwater, which must have been very perplexing to the fish. It announced ominously, "This reef is monitored." Duncan could see no trace of the projectors that had been very cunningly concealed. Todd was pointing ahead to the line of divers working along the edge of the reef. So he had not been joking. They really were going through the unmistakable motions of gardeners digging up noxious weeds, and each one was surrounded by a small cloud of brilliantly colored fish, clearly benefiting from all this activity. The coral formations seemed to be changing shape. Even to Duncan's untrained eye, they looked strange, even abnormal. He had grown accustomed to the branching antlers of the staghorns, the convoluted labyrinths that looked like giant brains, the delicate mushrooms, sometimes meters in diameter. They were still here, but now subtly distorted. Then he saw the first metallic glint, then another and another. As he came closer, and the blue haze of distance no longer softened the details of the underwater world, Duncan realized why this reef was cherished and protected. Everywhere he looked, it glittered and sparkled with gold. 200 years earlier, it had been one of the greatest triumphs of biological engineering, bringing world fame to its creators. Ironically, success had come when it was no longer required. What had been intended to fulfill a vital need had turned out to be no more than a technological cul-de-sac. It had been known for centuries that some marine organisms were able to extract, for the benefit of their own internal economies, elements present in seawater in unbelievably small proportions. If sponges and oysters and similar lowly creatures could perform such feats of chemical engineering with iodine or vanadium, the biologists of the 2100s had argued, why could they not be taught to do the same trick with more valuable elements? And so, by heroic feats of gene manipulation, several species of coral had been persuaded to become gold miners. The most successful were able to replace almost 10% of their limestone skeletons with the precious metal. That success, however, was measured only in human terms. Since gold normally plays no part in biochemical reactions, the consequences to the corals were disastrous. The auriferous reefs were never healthy and had to be carefully protected from predators and disease. Only a few hundred tons of gold were extracted by this technique before large-scale transmutation made it uneconomic. The nuclear furnaces could manufacture gold as cheaply as any other metal. For a while, the more accessible reefs were maintained as tourist attractions, but souvenir hunters soon demolished them. Now only one was left, and Dr. Mohammed's staff was determined to preserve it. So, at regular intervals, the doctors and nurses took time off from their usual duties and enjoyed an arduous working holiday on the reef. They dumped carefully selected fertilizers and antibiotics to improve the health of the living corals and waged war against its enemies. Particularly the spectacular crown-of-thorn starfish and its smaller relative, the spiny sea urchin. Duncan floated perfectly relaxed in the tepid water, lazily flippering from time to time, so that he remained in the shadow of the dinghy. Now he understood the purpose of those sinister knives and spikes. The adversaries they had to deal with were well protected indeed. Only a couple of meters beneath him, one of the divers was jabbing at a colony of small black spheres, each at the center of a formidable array of needle-sharp spines. From time to time, one of the spheres would be split open, and fish would dart in to grab the pieces of white meat that came floating out. It was a delicacy they could scarcely ever have enjoyed without human intervention. Duncan could not imagine that these spiky beasts had any natural enemies. The diver, one of the nurses, noticed the two spectators hovering overhead and beckoned Duncan to join her. He had become so fascinated that he now obeyed automatically, without a second's thought. Taking several deep breaths and partly exhaling on the last one, he hauled himself slowly down the line, anchoring the dinghy to its small grapnel. The distance was greater than he had imagined, more like 3 meters than 2, for he had forgotten the refractive effect of the water. Midway, his left ear gave a disconcerting click, but Dr. Todd had warned him about this, and he did not check his descent. When he reached the anchor and grabbed its shank, he felt a tremendous sense of achievement. He was a deep-sea diver. He had plumbed the fabulous depth of 3 meters. Well, at least 2.5. The glitter of gold was all around him. There was never more than a tiny speck, smaller than a grain of sand, at any one spot. But it was everywhere. The entire reef was impregnated with it. Duncan felt that he was floating beside the chef d'oeuvre of some mad jeweler, determined to create a Baroque masterpiece regardless of expense. Yet these pinnacles and plates and twisted spires were the work of mindless polyps, not, except indirectly, the products of human intelligence. Reluctantly, he shot up to the surface for air. This was easy. He felt ashamed of his previous fears. Now he understood how visitors often reacted to Titan. Next time, when someone politely declined an invitation to take a pleasant jaunt outside, he would be a little more tolerant. "What are those black things?" he asked Dr. Todd, who was still hovering watchfully above him. "Long-spined sea urchin, diadema, something or other. When you see so many, it's a sign of pollution or an unbalanced ecology. They don't really damage the reef, like a canthister, but they're ugly and a nuisance. If you back into one, the needles may take a month to work their way out. Are you going down again?" "Yes." "Good. Don't overdo it, and watch out for those spines." Duncan hauled himself down the anchor line once more, and the diver waved him a greeting as he approached. Then she offered him her deadly-looking knife and pointed toward a small group of sea urchins. Duncan nodded, took the tapering metal blade by the proffered handle, and started jabbing away inexpertly, being careful to avoid those ominous black needles. Not until then did he realize, to his considerable surprise, that these lowly animals were aware of his presence and were not relying merely on a static defense. The long spines were swinging toward him, orienting themselves in the direction of maximum danger. Presumably, it was only a simple automatic reflex, but it made him pause for a moment. There was more here than met the eye, perhaps the first faint intimations of dawning consciousness. His knife was longer than the sea urchin's spines, and he jabbed vigorously again and again. The carapace was surprisingly tough, but presently it gave way, and the waiting fish raced in to grab at the creamy white flesh that was suddenly exposed. And then, with growing discomfort, Duncan realized that his victim was not dying in silence. For some time, he had been aware of faint sounds in the water around him. The hammering of the other divers on the reef, the occasional clang of the anchor against the rocks, But this noise came from much closer at hand and was most peculiar, even disturbing. It was a crackling, grinding sound. Though the analogy was patently ridiculous, it could only be compared to the crunching of thousands of tiny teeth, clashing in rage and agony. Moreover, there was no doubt that it came from the eviscerated sea urchin. That faint, inhuman death rattle was so unexpected that Duncan checked his onslaught and remained hovering motionless in the water. He had completely forgotten the necessity for air, and the conscious part of his mind had dismissed the mounting symptoms of suffocation as irrelevant, to be dealt with later. But finally, he could ignore them no longer and shot gasping to the surface. With a profound sense of shock, even of shame, Duncan realized that he had just destroyed a living creature. He could never have imagined before he left Titan that such an experience would ever come his way. One could hardly feel much guilt over the murder of a sea urchin. Nevertheless, for the first time in his life, Duncan Mackenzie was a killer. Chapter 33, Sleuth. When Duncan returned to Washington, the second time bomb from Cullen was ticking away in the Centennial Hotel. Once again, it was so cryptic that it would have been almost unintelligible, even to an outsider who had succeeded in decoding it. Confirm your old friend has unauthorized account, 65842, Geneva Branch, First Bank, of Aristarchus. Balance several tens of thousands solars. This information not to be disclosed any circumstances. Presume from sale of titanite. Making inquiries, Nemosyne. Meanwhile, suggest you keep alert. Regards, Cullen. Duncan understood perfectly well why this information was not to be disclosed. The lunar banks guarded their secrets well, and heaven alone knew by what prodigies of persuasion or genteel blackmail Cullen had managed to get hold of Carl's account number. Even so, he had been unable to obtain a figure for the balance, but it was obviously considerable. 10,000 solars was far more than anyone would need for the purchase of a few Terran luxuries, and several times that was more than the Mackenzies held in their own perfectly legal accounts. Such an amount of money was more than a cause for envy. It was disturbing, especially if it was intended for some clandestine use. Duncan allowed himself a few moments of wistful daydreaming, imagining what he could do with 20,000 or 30,000 solars. Then he put the seductive vision firmly aside and concentrated all his mind upon the problem. While Carl's involvement had been only a vague suspicion, he had been reluctant to waste time on a detailed analysis of how, when, and, above all, why. But now that speculation had congealed into certainty, he could no longer evade the issue. What a pity that the obvious line of approach was out of the question. He could hardly call up the First Bank of Aristarchus and ask for a printout of account 65842. Not even the world government could do that, unless fraud or crime had already been proved beyond a shadow of a doubt. Even the most discreet inquiry would trigger an explosion. Someone would certainly be fired, and Cullen might be faced with the most embarrassing questions. The only real problem in life, an ancient philosopher had once said, is what to do next. There was still no link with Kalindi, or anyone else. Duncan did not relish playing a role in some sleazy old-time spy or detective melodrama, and was not even sure how one got started on such an enterprise. Cullen would have been much better at it. Of the three Mackenzies, he was the only one with any flair for subterfuge, indirection, and secrecy. He was probably enjoying himself, especially since he had never liked Carl, being one of the few people on Titan immune to his charms. But Cullen, though he was doing a remarkable job, was more than a billion kilometers away, at the end of an expensive 3-hour time lag. There was no one on Earth in whom Duncan could confide. This was a private Titanian matter, and might yet turn out to be a storm in a teacup. However, if it was serious, the fewer people who knew about it, the better. Duncan considered and dismissed the idea of talking to Ambassador Farrell. He might have to enter the picture later, but not now. Duncan had not been too impressed with Bob Farrell's discretion, and of course he was a Terran. Moreover, if the embassy discovered that there was a large amount of masterless money floating around Earth, that would undoubtedly precipitate a tug of war. It was true that the rent on Wyoming Avenue had to be paid, but Titan's demands were even more urgent. And yet, perhaps, there was one Terran he could trust. The man who had raised the matter in the first place, and who was equally interested in finding the answer. Duncan tapped out the name on his console, wondering if it would accept that ridiculous apostrophe. He had managed to misplace the dealer's card, which would have placed the call automatically. "Mr. Mandelstam," he said when the screen lit up. "Duncan Mackenzie. I have some news for you. Where can we meet for a private conversation?" "Are you absolutely certain," said Duncan anxiously, "that no one can overhear us?" You've been seeing too many historical films, Mr. Mackenzie, Ivor Mandelstam replied. This isn't the 20th century, and it would take a singularly determined police state to bug every auto jitney in Washington. I always do my confidential business cruising around and round on the mall. There's absolutely nothing to worry about. Very well. It's imperative that this doesn't go any further. I'm fairly sure that I know the source of the titanite. What's more, I have a very good idea of the Terran agent, who has apparently already made some substantial sales. I've discovered that, said Mandelstam a little glumly. Do you know how substantial? Several tens of thousands of solars. To Duncan's surprise, Mandelstam brightened appreciably. Oh, is that all? He exclaimed. I'm quite relieved. And can you give me the name of the prime agent? I've been operating through a very close-mouthed intermediary. Duncan hesitated. I believe you implied that no Terran laws were being broken. Correct. There's no import duty on extraterrestrial gems. Everything at this end is perfectly legal. Unless, of course, the Titanite is stolen and the Terran agent is an accomplice. I'm sure that isn't the case. You see, and it's not really as big a coincidence as you might think, the agent is a friend of mine. A knowing smile creased Mandelstam's face. I appreciate your problem. No, you don't, Duncan told himself. It was an excruciatingly complicated situation. He was quite sure now why Kalindi had been avoiding him. Carl would have warned her that he was coming to Earth, and would have advised her to keep out of his way. Yes, Carl must have been very worried up there on Little Mnemosyne, lest Duncan stumble upon his activities. It was essential to keep completely out of the picture. Kalindi must never guess that he knew. There was no way in which she could possibly link him with Mandelstam, with whom she was already dealing through her own exceedingly discreet intermediary. Yet still Duncan hesitated, like a chess master over a crucial move. He was analyzing his own motives and his own conscience, for his personal and official interests were now almost inextricably entangled. He was anxious to find out what Carl was doing, and if necessary, frustrate him. He wanted to make Kalindi ashamed of her deceit and possibly turn her embarrassment to his emotional advantage. This was a rather forlorn hope. Kalindi did not embarrass easily, if at all. And he wanted to help Titan, and thereby the Mackenzies. All these objectives were not likely to be compatible. Duncan began to wish that Titanite had never been discovered. Yet undoubtedly, there was a brilliant opportunity here, if only he had the wit to make his moves correctly. Their auto-jitney was now gliding at the breathless speed of some 20 clicks between the Capitol and the Library of Congress. The sight reminded Duncan of his other responsibility. Already it was the last week in June, yet his speech still consisted of no more than a few sheets of notes. Over-preparation was one of the Mackenzie failings. The all-right-on-the-night attitude was wholly alien to their natures. But even allowing for this often valuable fault, of which he was well aware, Duncan was beginning to feel a mild sense of panic. The problem was a very simple one, yet its diagnosis had not suggested a remedy. Try as he could, Duncan had still been unable to decide on a basic theme, or any message from Titan more inspiring than the usual zero-content official greetings. Mandelstam was still waiting patiently when they passed the Rayburn building, now encrusted with a vast banyan tree, brought all the way from Angkor Wat. It was hoped that within the next 50 years this would do the job of demolition at virtually no public expense. There were times when aesthetics took precedence over history, and it was generally agreed that, unlike the old Smithsonian, the Rayburn building was not quite hideous enough to be worth preservation. But what would that vegetable octopus do next, the professional alarmists had worried, when it had finished this task? Would the monster crawl across Independence Avenue and attack the hallowed dome? Now the jitney was cruising past the prone 100 meters of the Saturn V replica, lying on what had once been the site of NASA headquarters. They could not spend all day orbiting central Washington. Very well, Duncan told himself with a sigh. I have your promise that my name won't come out under any circumstances?
Yes.
And there's no risk that my friend may get into trouble? I can't guarantee that he won't lose any money. But there will be no legal problems, at any rate under Terran jurisdiction. It's not a he. I leave the details to you, but you might make some tactful inquiries about the vice president of Enigma Associates, Catherine Lyndon Ellerman. Chapter 34, Starday. Though he tried to convince himself that he had done the right thing, even the only thing, Duncan was still slightly ashamed. Deep in his heart, he felt that he had been guilty of betraying an old friendship. He was glad that some impulse had kept him from mentioning Carl, and with part of his mind he still hoped that Mandelstam and Colin would run into blank walls so that the whole investigation would collapse. Meanwhile, there was so much to be done, and so much to see, that for long periods of time Duncan could forget his twinges of conscience. It seemed ridiculous to have come all the way to Earth, and then to sit for hours of every day, in beautiful weather, in a hotel room, talking into a console. But every time Duncan thought he had completed one of the innumerable chores they had given him before he left home, there would be a backup message reopening the subject or adding fresh complications. His official duties were time-consuming enough. What made matters worse were all the private requests from relatives, friends, and even complete strangers who assumed that he had nothing else to do except contact lost acquaintances, obtain photos of ancestral homes, hunt for rare books, research Terran genealogies, locate obscure works of art, act as an agent for hopeful Titanian authors and artists, conjure up scholarships and free passages to Earth, and say thank you for Starday cards received 10 years ago and never acknowledged. Which reminded Duncan that he had not sent off his own cards for this quadrennial occasion. Since 76 was a leap year, Starday was therefore looming up in the near future, to be precise between June 30th and July 1st. Duncan was glad of the extra day, but it also meant that there would shortly be 3 days in five where no business could be done. For July 1st, being at the beginning of a new quarter, was of course a Sunday, and the Sunday before that was only June 28th. It was bad enough in an ordinary year to have 2 Sundays at the end of every 91-day quarter, with only a Monday and Tuesday between them, but now to have another holiday as well made it even worse. There was still time to mail cards to all his Terran friends, Ambassador Farrell, the Washingtons, Kalindi, Bernie Petras, and half a dozen others. As for Titan, there was really no hurry. Even if they took 6 months to get there, the cards with their beautiful gold leaf centennial stamps, 5 solars each, for heaven's sake, even by second-class space mail, would still be appreciated. Despite these problems, Duncan had found some opportunities to relax. He had been on personal teletours of London, Rome, and Athens, which was the next best thing to being there in the flesh. Seated in a tiny, darkened cubicle with 360 degrees of high-quality sound and vision, he could easily believe that he was actually walking through the streets of the ancient cities. He could ask questions of the invisible guide who was his alter ego, talk to any passers-by, change the route to look more closely at something that took his interest. Only the senses of smell and touch remained immobile, and even these could be tele-extended for anyone willing to foot the bill. Duncan could not afford such a marginal luxury and did not really miss it. He also attended several concerts, 2 ballets, and 1 play. All arranged for the benefit of visitors in this centennial year, and all unavoidable without the exercise of more diplomatic illness or sheer bad manners than Duncan felt able to muster. The music, though doubtless magnificent, bored him. His tastes were old-fashioned, and he enjoyed little written after the 21st century. The ballet was also a disappointment. To anyone who had spent all his life at a fifth of gravity, the most remarkable of Terran grands jetés was unimpressive. And also nerve-wracking, for Duncan could never quite get over the fear that the dancers would injure themselves. He watched them with envy, but he had no wish to imitate them. It was enough that he could now walk and stand without conscious effort. This achievement was a matter of modest pride, for there had been a time when he would not have believed it possible. But the play delighted him. He had heard vaguely of George Bernard Shaw, now undergoing one of his periodic revivals, and The Devil's Disciple was perfect for the occasion. Though George Washington muttered from time to time in Duncan's ear such comments as, "General Burgoyne wasn't the least like that," he felt that he at least understood the American Revolution in human terms. It was no longer a shadowy affair of 2-dimensional puppets 500 years in the past, but a life and death struggle involving real people whose hopes and fears and loves he could share. Though love, with a capital L, was not a complication that Duncan would welcome during his stay on Earth. He could not imagine anyone ever replacing Marissa, and to have a really serious affair with a Terran would be the stuff of tragedy, since separation would be inevitable when he returned to Titan. He wanted no part of that. He had been through it once before with Kalindi. Or so it had seemed at the time. Now he realized that the calf love of a 16-year-old boy, though it had once dominated all his waking hours, was indeed shallow and transient. Yet its after-effects still lingered, shaping all his later passions and desires. Although he was annoyed and disappointed with Kalindi, that was unchanged. Her deliberate avoidance had, if anything, added fuel to his emotions and contributed to some notably fevered dreams. Bernie Petras, of course, was happy to relieve his symptoms and had arranged several enjoyable encounters. One cuddlesome and talented young lady, he swore, was his own girlfriend, who only does this with people she really wants to meet. She did indeed show a genuine interest in Titan and its problems. But when Bernie, as an interested party, wanted to join in the festivities, Duncan selfishly threw him out. That was shortly before Ivor Mandelstam, this time in the Penn Mass auto jitney, totally demolished his peace of mind. They had just left the DuPont Circle interchange when he told Duncan, "I've some interesting news for you, but I don't know what it means. You may be able to explain it. I'll do my best. I think I can claim, without much exaggeration or conceit, that I can get to anyone on Earth in one jump. But sometimes discretion suggests doing it in two, and that's how I proceeded with Miss Ellerman. I've never had any dealings with her personally, or so I thought, until you advised me otherwise, but we have mutual friends. So I got one whom I can trust without question to give her a call. Tell me, have you tried to contact her recently?" "Not for at least a week. I thought it better to keep out of the way." Duncan did not add to this perfectly good excuse the fact that he had felt ashamed to face Kalindi. "She answered my friend's call, but there's something very odd. She wouldn't switch on her vidi." That certainly was peculiar. As a matter of common good manners, one never overrode the vision circuit unless there was a very good excuse indeed. Of course, this could sometimes cause acute embarrassment, a fact exploited to the utmost in countless comedies. But whatever the real reason, social protocol demanded some explanation. To say that the vidi was out of order was to invite total disbelief, even on those rare occasions when it was true. "What was her excuse?" asked Duncan. "A plausible one. She explained that she'd had a bad fall, and apologized for not showing her face. I hope she wasn't badly hurt." "Apparently not, though she sounded rather unhappy. Anyway, my friend had a brief conversation with her and raised the subject of Titan, quite legitimately, and in a way that couldn't possibly arouse suspicion. He knew that she'd been there, and asked if she could put him in touch with any Titanians she happened to know on Earth. Actually, he said he had an export order in mind." "Not a very good story. All business is handled through the Embassy Trade Division, and he could have contacted them. If I may say so, Mr. Mackenzie, you still have a lot to learn. I can think of half a dozen reasons for not going to the Embassy, at least for the first approach. My friend knows that, and you can be sure that Miss Ellerman does. If you say so, I don't doubt that you're right. What was her reaction?" "I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed. She said that she did have a good Titanian friend who might be able to help, that he just arrived for the celebrations, and he was in Washington." Duncan began to laugh. The anticlimax was so ridiculous. "So your friend wasted his time. We're right back where we started." "Along this line, yes. I thought you'd be amused. But there's rather more to come." "Go on," said Duncan, his confidence in Mandelstam now somewhat diminished by this debacle. "I tried several other lines of inquiry, but they all came to nothing. I even thought of calling Miss Ellerman myself and saying outright that I knew she was the principal behind the Titanite negotiations, without accusing her of anything, of course. I'm glad you didn't." "Oh, it would have been a perfectly reasonable thing to do. She wouldn't be surprised if I found out sooner or later. But as it happened, I had a better idea, one I should have tried in the first place. I checked on her visitors for the last month." "How," Duncan asked in astonishment, "could you do that? It's the oldest trick in the world." "Have you never seen one of those 20th century French detective films?" "No, I suppose not. I simply asked the concierge."
"The what?"
"You don't have them on Titan. I don't even know what they are." "Perhaps you're lucky. On Earth, they're an indispensable nuisance. Miss Ellerman, as I assume you know, lives in a very luxurious deep ten just south of Mount Rockefeller. In fact, she has the basement penthouse. A hankering I've never understood. The farther down I go, the more claustrophobic I get. Well, any large complex has a doorkeeper at the entrance to tell visitors who's in and who's out, take messages, accept deliveries, and authorize the right people to go to the right apartments. That's the concierge." "And you were able to get at its memory bank?" Mandelstam had the grace to look slightly embarrassed. "It's surprising what can be done if you know the right people." "Oh, don't misunderstand. There was nothing illegal, but I prefer to omit details. On Titan, we're very particular about invasion of privacy. So are we on Earth. Anyone who really wants to do so can easily bypass the concierge. Which, in fact, suggests to me that Miss Ellerman does not have a guilty conscience, or anything to hide. But tell me, Mr. Mackenzie, didn't you know that she had a Titanian guest staying with her?" Duncan stared at him open-mouthed, but quickly recovered himself. "Of course. Carl might well have prevailed on some trusted friend to act as a courier. That must have been a good many months ago. There had been no passenger ship for 6 weeks before Sirius. Who could possibly... That could wait. There was another little matter to clear up first. You said staying with her?" "Yes. That is, until only 2 days ago. That explained everything, almost. No wonder Kalindi had avoided him. In equal measure, Duncan felt jealousy, disappointment, and relief that his maneuverings had, after all, been justified by events. Who is this Titanian, he asked glumly. I wonder if I know him. Well, that's what I'll be interested to hear. His name is Carl Helmer. Chapter 35, A Message from Titan. That's utterly impossible, said Duncan, when he had recovered from the initial shock. I left Helmer at Saturn, and I came here on the fastest ship in the solar system. Mandelstam gave an expressive shrug. Then perhaps someone else is using that name for reasons best known to himself. Miss Elliman's concierge is not very bright. They seldom are. And incidentally, we were lucky to get at it just before the regular end-of-the-month memory update. I got hold of the visual recognition coding, and here's the reconstruction. He handed over the crude but perfectly adequate synthesis. Duncan could identify it as quickly as any robot pattern-detecting circuit. Without question, it was Carl. So you know him, said Mandelstam. Very well, Duncan replied faintly. His mind was still in a whirl. Even now, he could not fully believe the evidence of his eyes. It would take a long time for him to work out all the implications of this stunning development. You said he was no longer at Miss Elliman's? Do you know where he is now? No. I was hoping you might have some ideas. But now that we know the name, I'll be able to trace him, though it may take some time. And doubtless expense, thought Duncan. Tell me, Mr. Mandelstam, why are you taking all this trouble? Frankly, I don't see what you hope to get out of it. Don't you? Well, it's a good question. I certainly began this out of a pure and honest lust for Titanite, and I hope that in due course my efforts will win their just reward. But now it's gone beyond that. The only thing more valuable than gems or works of art is entertainment. And this little caper, Mr. Mackenzie, is more interesting than anything I've seen on the Viddy for weeks. Despite his gloomy preoccupations, Duncan could not help smiling. He had been cautious in his approach to Mandelstam, but now he was definitely beginning to feel genuine warmth toward the dealer. He was shrewd and perhaps even crafty, and Duncan did not doubt that he would drive a very hard bargain. But he was now quite convinced that George Washington was right. Ivor Mandelstam could be trusted implicitly in all the things that really mattered. May I make a modest proposal? Of course, Duncan answered. Can you think of any reason at all, now that we've reached this stage, why you should not call Miss Elliman? Say that you've just heard from Titan that your mutual friend Mr. Helmer is on Earth, and does she know where he is? Duncan thought it over. The suggestion was so blatantly obvious that in his somewhat dazed state he had completely overlooked it. Even now he was not sure that he could give it an accurate evaluation. But the affair was no longer a matter of impersonal tactics and policy, to be worked out like the closing move of some chess game. For his own self-respect and peace of mind, it was time for a confrontation with Kalindi. You're right, he said. There's no reason at all why I shouldn't call her. I'll do so just as soon as I can get back to the hotel. Let's stop off at Union Station and take the express. When Duncan reached the hotel 20 minutes later, the express was somewhat misnamed. He had the second surprise of the day, though by now it was something of an anticlimax. The longest fax that Cullen had ever sent him was waiting in the console. After the initial quick reading, Duncan's first reaction was, this time, at least I'm one jump ahead. But even that, he realized, was not quite true. When one allowed for the fact that Cullen's message had left Titan 2 hours ago, it was virtually a photo finish. Security AAA, priority AAA. Inquiries, Nemosyne, disclosed Carl left mid-March on non-sked Earth flight and arrived approximately 2 weeks before you. Armand professes surprise and total ignorance. Maybe telling truth. Imperative you locate Carl, find what he is doing, and if necessary, warn him of consequences. Proceed with extreme caution. As anxious, avoid publicity or interplanetary complications. You appreciate the situation may be to our advantage, but discretion essential. Suggest Kalindi may know where he is. Colin and Malcolm. Duncan reread the message more slowly, absorbing its nuances. It contained nothing that he did not now know, or had not already guessed. However, he did not relish its uncompromising tone. Being signed by both Colin and Malcolm, it had the authority of a direct order, something rare indeed in Mackenzie affairs. Though Duncan admitted that it made good sense, he could also detect an underlying note of satisfaction. For a moment, he had an unflattering image of his older twins moving in like a pair of vultures, scenting a kill. At the same time, he was wryly amused to see that Colin had drafted the telex in a great hurry. It contained half a dozen superfluous words, most offensive to the economical maxims of the clan. Why, there were even Anns and these. Perhaps, after all, he was not suited for politics. He felt a growing disenchantment with these machinations. There were, despite genetics, subtle differences between the Mackenzies, and it might well be that he was not as tough or as ambitious as his precursors. In any event, his first step was obvious, especially as all his advisors had suggested it. The second move could be decided later. It was no surprise when Kalindi failed to appear on the screen of his comsol, and he soon had proof that the social convention was justified. Unless there was some excellent reason, it was indeed bad manners to switch off one's vidi-circuit. Duncan felt both frustrated and at a serious disadvantage, knowing that Kalindi could see him, but that he could not see her. The voice alone did not convey all the shades of emotion. There were so many times when the expression of the eyes could contradict the spoken word. "Why, what's the matter, Kalindi?" said Duncan in a feigned astonishment. He would feel genuine sympathy if she were indeed hurt, but he intended to reserve judgment. Her voice was, could it be imagination on his part, not quite under control. She appeared surprised to see him, perhaps disconcerted. "I'm terribly sorry, Duncan. I'd rather not show my face at the moment. I fell and hurt my eye. It looks ghastly. But there's nothing to worry about. It will be all right in a few days." "I'm sorry to hear that. I won't bother you if you feel unwell." He waited, hoping that Kalindi could read the concern that he had carefully imprinted on his face. "Oh, that's no problem. Otherwise, it's business as usual. I've just cut out my weekly trip to the office and now do everything by console." "Well, that's a relief. Now, I've got a piece of news for you. Carl is on Earth." There was a long silence before Kalindi replied. When she finally answered, Duncan realized with amused mortification that he was not really in her league. He could not hope to outwit her for very long. "Duncan," she said in a resigned tone of voice, "you really didn't know that he was staying with me?" Duncan did his best to exhibit incredulity, shock, and umbrage, in that order. "Why didn't you tell me?" he cried. "Because he asked me not to. That put me in a difficult position, but what was I to do? He said you were no longer on good terms, and his business was highly confidential." Duncan guessed that Kalindi was telling the simple truth, if indeed the truth was simple. Some, but not all, of his pique evaporated. "Well, I'm upset and disappointed. I should have thought you'd have trusted me. Anyway, there's no further need for subterfuge, now that I know he's here. I've an urgent message for him. Where can I locate him?" There was another long pause. Then Kalindi answered, "I don't know where he is. He left suddenly and never told me where he was going. He might even have returned to Titan. Without saying goodbye? Hardly. And there are no ships to Titan for a month. But then I suppose he's still on Earth. Or no farther away than the moon. I simply don't know." Oddly enough, Duncan believed her. Her voice still had the ring of truth, though he did not delude himself about her power to deceive him as she wished. "In that case, I'll have to trace him in some other way. It's imperative that we meet." "I wouldn't advise that, Duncan." "Why ever not? He's very angry with you." "I can't imagine the reason," retorted Duncan, swiftly imagining several. Kalindi's voice sounded such a genuine note of alarm that he felt himself responding strongly to her concern. However, it seemed that this avenue was closed, at least for the time being. He knew better than to argue with Kalindi. With a mixture of emotions, he expressed hopes for her continued improvement and broke the circuit. He hoped that she would interpret his attitude as one of both sorrow and anger, and feel correspondingly contrite. A minute later, he was looking with some relief at a screen that was no longer empty and could reveal the other party's reactions. "Did you know," he asked Ambassador Farrell, "that Carl Helmer is on Earth?" His Excellency blinked. "I certainly did not. He never contacted me. I'll see if the Chancery knows anything." He punched a few buttons, and it was obvious that nothing happened. The ambassador glanced at Duncan with annoyance. "I wish we could afford a new intercom system," he said accusingly. "They cost a very small fraction of the Titan gross national product." Duncan thought it wise to let this pass, and luckily on the second attempt the ambassador got through. He muttered a few inaudible questions, waited for a minute, then looked at Duncan and shook his head. No trace of him. Not even a Terran forwarding address for any messages from home. Most odd. Wouldn't you say unprecedented? Yes. I've never heard of anyone failing to contact the embassy as soon as they reach Earth. Usually, of course, we know that they're coming weeks in advance. There's no law compelling them to get in touch, but it's a matter of courtesy, not to mention convenience. That's what I thought. Well, if you hear anything of him, would you let me know? The ambassador stared back at him in silence for a moment, with the most enigmatic of smiles on his face. Then he said, What do Malcolm and Colin think he's doing? Plotting a coup d'etat with smuggled guns? After a moment's shock, Duncan laughed at the joke. Not even Carl is that crazy. Frankly, I'm completely baffled by the whole thing, but I'm determined to locate him. Though there may be 500 million people on Earth, he's not exactly inconspicuous. Please keep in touch. Goodbye for the present. Two down, thought Duncan, and one to go. It was back to Ivor Mandelstam in his self-appointed and by no means unsuccessful role of private eye. But Ivor's comsoul answered, "Please do not disturb. Kindly record any message." Duncan was annoyed. He was bursting to pass on his news, but was certainly not going to leave it stored in a comsoul. He would have to wait until Mandelstam called back. That took 2 hours. And meanwhile, it was not easy to concentrate on other work. When the dealer finally returned the call, he apologized profusely. "I was trying a long shot," he explained. "I wondered if he'd bought anything in New York on a credit card. There aren't all that number of H's, and the central billing computers zipped through them in an hour. Alas, he must be using cash. Not a federal crime, of course, but a nuisance to us honest investigators." Duncan laughed. "It was a good idea. I've done slightly better. At least I've eliminated some possibilities." He gave Mandelstam a brief resume of his discussions with Kalindi and Ambassador Farrell, then added, "Where do we go from here?" "I'm not sure, but don't worry, I'll think of something." Duncan believed him. He now had an almost unreasoning confidence in the dealer's ingenuity, not to mention his influence and his knowledge of the ways of Earth. If anyone could locate Carl, short of going to the police or inserting a personal appeal in the World Times, it would be Mandelstam. In fact, it took him only 36 hours. Chapter 36, The Eye of Allah. "I found him," said Mandelstam. "He looked tired, but victorious." "I knew you would," Duncan replied with unfeigned admiration. "Where is he?" "Don't be so impatient. Let me have my reasonably innocent fun. I've earned it." "Well, whose concierge did you bamboozle this time?" Mandelstam looked slightly pained. "Nobody's. I first tried to find out all I could about your friend, Helmer, by the brilliant device of looking him up in the interplanetary Who's Who. I assumed he'd be there, and he was. 100-line printout. I looked you up at the same time, by the way. You rate 150 lines, if that's any satisfaction." "I know," said Duncan, with what patience he could muster. "Go on." "I wondered if it would list any Terran contacts or interests, and again I was in luck. He belongs to the Institution of Electronic Engineers, the Royal Astronomical Society, the Institute of Physics, and the Institute of Astronautics, as well as several Titanian professional organizations, of course. And I see he's written 6 scientific papers, and been joint author in others. The Ionosphere of Saturn, Origins of Ultra-Long-Wave Electromagnetic Radiation, and other thrilling esoterica. Nothing of any use to us, though. The Royal Astronomers are in London, of course, but the engineers and astronauts and physicists are all in New York, and I wondered if he'd contacted them. So I called on another of my useful friends, a scientist this time, and a most distinguished one, who could open any doors without questions being asked. I hoped that a visiting Titanian colleague was a rare enough phenomenon to attract attention, and indeed he was. Mandelstam gave another of his pregnant pauses so that Duncan could simmer for a while, then went on. "This is what puzzles me. Apart from ignoring the embassy and telling Miss Ellerman to keep quiet, he's done absolutely nothing to cover his tracks. I don't think that anyone with much to hide would behave in that way. It was really very simple. The electronics people were happy to help. They told us he'd left North Atlanta and could be contacted care of the Assistant Chief Engineer, Division C, World Communications Headquarters, Tehran. Not the sort of address you'd associate with gem smuggling and interplanetary skullduggery. So, over to Tehran. Just in time to miss him, but no matter. He'll be at the same location now for a couple of days, and in view of his background, at last, we've got something that makes a little sense. WorldCom's Division C are the boys who keep Project Cyclops running, and even I've heard of that. It had been conceived in the first bright dawn of the space age, the largest, most expensive, and potentially most promising scientific instrument ever devised. Though it could serve many purposes, one was paramount, the search for intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. One of the oldest dreams of mankind, this remained no more than a dream until the rise of radio astronomy in the second half of the 20th century. Then, within the short span of 2 decades, the combined skills of the engineers and the scientists gave humanity power to span the interstellar gulfs, if it was willing to pay the price. The first puny radio telescopes, a few tens of meters in diameter, had listened hopefully for signals from the stars. No one had really expected success from these pioneering efforts, nor was it achieved. Making certain plausible assumptions about the distribution of intelligence in the galaxy, it was easy to calculate that the detection of a radio-emitting civilization would require telescopes not decameters, but kilometers in aperture. There was only one practical method of achieving this result, at least with structures confined to the surface of the Earth. To build a single giant bowl was out of the question, but the same result could be obtained from an array of hundreds of smaller ones. Cyclops was visualized as an antenna farm of 100-meter dishes uniformly spaced over a circle perhaps 5 kilometers across. The faint signals from each element in this army of antennas would be added together, and then cunningly processed by computers programmed to look for the unique signatures of intelligence against the background of cosmic noise. The whole system would cost as much as the original Apollo project, but unlike Apollo, it could proceed in installments over a period of years or even decades. As soon as a relatively few antennas had been built, Cyclops could start operating. From the very beginning, it would be a tool of immense value to the radio astronomers. Over the years, more and more antennas could be installed, until eventually the whole array was filled in. And all the while, Cyclops would steadily increase in power and capability, able to probe deeper and deeper into the universe. It was a noble vision, though there were some who feared its success as much as its possible failure. However, during the time of troubles that brought the 20th century to its unlamented close, there was little hope of funding such a project. It could be considered only during a period of political and financial stability, and therefore Cyclops did not get underway until 100 years after the initial design studies. A child of the brief but brilliant Muslim Renaissance, it helped to absorb some of the immense wealth accumulated by the Arab countries during the oil age. The millions of tons of metal required came from the virtually limitless resources of the Red Sea brines, oozing up along the Great Rift Valley. Here, where the crust of the earth was literally coming apart at the seams, as the continental plates slowly separated, were metals and minerals enough to banish all fear of shortages for centuries to come. Ideally, Cyclops should have been situated on the equator, so that its questing radio mirrors could sweep the heavens from pole to pole. Other requirements were a good climate, freedom from earthquakes or other natural disasters, and if possible, a ring of mountains to act as a shield against radio interference. Of course, no perfect site existed, and political, geographical, and engineering compromises had to be made. After decades of often acrimonious discussion, the desolate, empty quarter of Saudi Arabia was chosen. It was the first time that anyone had ever found a use for it. Wide tracks were roughly graded through the wilderness so that 10,000-ton hover freighters could carry in components from the factories on the shore of the Red Sea. Later, these were supplemented by cargo airships. In the first phase of the project, 60 parabolic antennas were arranged in the form of a giant cross, its 5-kilometer arms extending north, south, east, west. Some of the faithful objected to this symbol of an alien religion, but it was explained to them that this was only a temporary state of affairs. When the Eye of Allah was completed, the offending sign would be utterly lost in the total array of 700 huge dishes, spaced uniformly over a circle 80 square kilometers in extent. By the end of the 21st century, however, only half of the planned 700 elements had been installed. 200 of them had filled in most of the central core of the array, and the rest formed a kind of picket fence, outlining the circumference of the giant instrument. This reduction in scale, while saving billions of solars, had degraded performance only slightly. Cyclops had fulfilled virtually all its design objectives, and during the course of the 22nd century had wrought almost as great a revolution in astronomy as had the reflectors on Mount Wilson and Mount Palomar 200 years earlier. By the end of that century, however, it had run into trouble, through no fault of its builders or of the army of engineers and scientists who served it. Cyclops could not compete with the systems that had now been built on the far side of the moon. Almost perfectly shielded from terrestrial interference by 3,000 kilometers of solid rock, for many decades it had worked in conjunction with them for two great telescopes at either end of an Earth-Moon baseline formed an interferometer that could probe details of planetary systems hundreds of light years away. But now there were radio telescopes on Mars. The Lunar Observatory could achieve far more with their cooperation than it could ever do with nearby Earth. A baseline 200 million kilometers long allowed one to survey the surrounding stars with a precision never before imagined. As happens sooner or later with all scientific instruments, technical developments had bypassed Cyclops. But by the mid-23rd century, it was facing another problem, which might well prove fatal. The empty quarter was no longer a desert. Cyclops had been built in a region which might see no rains for 5 years at a time. At Al-Hadida, there were meteorites that had lain unrusting in the sand since the days of the Prophet. All this had been changed by reforestation and climate control. For the first time since the ice ages, the deserts were in retreat. More rain now fell on the empty quarter in days than had once fallen in years. The makers of Cyclops had never anticipated this. They had, reasonably enough, based all their designs on a hot, arid environment. Now the maintenance staff was engaged in a continual battle against corrosion, humidity in coaxial cables, fungus-induced breakdowns in high-tension circuits, and all the other ills that afflict electronic equipment if given the slightest chance. Some of the 100-meter antennas had even rusted up solidly, so that they could no longer be moved and had to be taken out of service. For almost 20 years, the system had been working at slowly decreasing efficiency, while the engineers, administrators, and scientists carried out a triangular argument, no one party being able to convince either of the others. Was it worth investing billions of solars to refurbish the system, or would the money be better spent on the other side of the moon? It was impossible to arrive at any clear-cut decision, for no one had ever been able to put a value on pure scientific research. Whatever its present problems, Cyclops had been a spectacular success, helping reshape man's views of the universe not once, but many times. It had pushed back the frontiers of knowledge to the very microsecond after the Big Bang itself, and had trapped radio waves that had circumnavigated the entire span of creation. It had probed the surfaces of distant stars, detected their hidden planets, and discovered such strange entities as neutrino suns, Antikythereans, gravitational lenses, spacequakes, and revealed the mind-wrenching realms of negative probability, ghost states, and inverted matter. But there was one thing that it had not done. Despite scores of false alarms, it had never succeeded in detecting signals from intelligent beings elsewhere in the universe. Either man was alone, or nobody else was using radio transmitters. The two explanations seemed equally improbable. Chapter 37. Meeting at Cyclops. He had known what to expect, or so he had believed, but the reality was still overwhelming. Duncan felt like a child in a forest of giant metal trees extending in every direction to the limit of vision. Each of the identical trees had a slightly tapering trunk, 50 meters high, with a stairway spiraling around it up to the platform supporting the drive mechanism. Looming above this was the huge yet surprisingly delicate 100-meter-wide bowl of the antenna itself, tilted toward the sky as it listened for signals from the deeps of space. Antenna 005, as its number indicated, was near the center of the array, but it was impossible to tell this by visual inspection. Whichever way Duncan looked, the ranks and columns of steel towers dwindled into the distance until eventually they formed a solid wall of metal. The whole vast array was a miracle of precision engineering, on a scale matched nowhere else on Earth. It was altogether appropriate that many key components had been manufactured in space. The foamed metals and crystal fibers which gave the parabolic reflectors strength with lightness could be produced only by the zero-gravity orbiting factories. In more ways than one, Cyclops was a child of space. Duncan turned to the guide who had driven him through the labyrinth of access tunnels on the small, chemically powered scooter. "I don't see anyone," he complained. "Are you sure he's here?" "This is where we left him an hour ago. He'll be in the pre-amplifier assembly up there on the platform. You'll have to shout. No radios allowed here, of course." Duncan could not help smiling at this further example of the Cyclops management's almost fanatical precautions against interference. He had even been asked to surrender his watch lest its feeble electronic pulses be mistaken for signals from an alien civilization a few hundred light years away. His guide was actually wearing a spring-driven timepiece, the first that Duncan had ever seen. Cupping his hands around his mouth, Duncan tilted his head toward the metal tower looming above him and shouted, "Carl!" A fraction of a second later, the K echoed back from the next antenna, then reverberated feebly from the ones beyond. After that, the silence seemed more profound than before. Duncan did not feel like disturbing it again. Nor was there any need. 50 meters above, a figure had moved to the railing around the platform, and had brought with it the familiar glint of gold. "Who's there?" "Who do you think?" Duncan asked himself. Of course, it was hard to recognize a person from vertically overhead, and voices were distorted in this inhumanly scaled place. "It's Duncan!" There was a pause that seemed to last for the better part of a minute, but could only have been a few seconds in actuality. Carl was obviously surprised, though by this time he must surely have guessed that Duncan knew of his presence on Earth. Then he answered, "I'm in the middle of a job. Come up if you want to." That was hardly a welcome, but the voice did not seem hostile. The only emotion that Duncan could identify at this distance was a kind of tired resignation, and perhaps he was imagining even this. Carl had vanished again, doubtless to continue whatever task he had come here to perform. Duncan looked very thoughtfully at the spiral stairway winding up the cylindrical trunk of the antenna tower. 50 meters was a trifling distance, but not in terms of Earth's gravity. It was the equivalent of 250 on Titan. He had never had to climb a quarter of a kilometer on his own world. Carl, of course, would have had little difficulty, since he had spent his early years on Earth, and his muscles would have recovered much of their original strength. Duncan wondered if this was a deliberate challenge. That would be typical of Carl, and if so, he had no choice in the matter. As he stepped onto the first of the perforated metal stairs, his Cyclops guide remarked hopefully, "There's not much room up there on the platform. Unless you want me, I'll stay here." Duncan could recognize a lazy man when he met one, but he was glad to accept the excuse. He did not wish any strangers to be present when he came face to face with Carl. The confrontation was one that he would have avoided if it had been at all possible, but this was not a job that could be delegated to anyone else, even if those instructions from Cullen and Malcolm had allowed it. The climb was easy enough, though the safety rail was not as substantial as Duncan would have wished. Moreover, sections had been badly rusted, and now that he was close enough to touch the metal, he could see that the mounting was in even worse condition than he had been led to expect. Unless emergency repairs were carried out very soon, Cyclops would never see the dawn of the 24th century. When Duncan had completed his first circuit, the guide called up to him. "I forgot to tell you. We're selecting a new target in about 5 minutes. You'll find it rather dramatic." Duncan stared up at the huge bowl now completely blocking the sky above him. The thought of all those tons of metal swinging around just overhead was quite disturbing, and he was glad that he had been warned in time. The other saw his action and interpreted it correctly. "It won't bother you. This antenna's been frozen for at least 10 years. The drive's seized up and not worth repairing." So that confirmed a suspicion of Duncan's, which he had dismissed as an optical illusion. The great parabola above him was indeed at a slight angle to all the others. It was no longer an active part of the Cyclops array, but was now pointing blindly at the sky. The loss of one or even a dozen elements would cause only a slight degradation of the system, but it was typical of the general air of neglect. One more circuit, and he would be at the platform. Duncan paused for breath. He had been climbing very slowly, but already his legs were beginning to ache with the wholly unaccustomed effort. There had been no further sound from Carl. What was he doing in this fantastic place of old triumphs and lost dreams? And how would he react to this unexpected and doubtless unwelcome confrontation when they were face to face? A little belatedly, it occurred to Duncan that a small platform 50 meters above the ground, and in this frightful gravity, was not the best place to have an argument. He smiled at the mental image this conjured up. Whatever their disagreement, violence was unthinkable. Well, not quite unthinkable. He had just thought of it. Overhead now was a narrow band of perforated metal flooring, barely wide enough for the rectangular slot through which the stairway emerged. With a heartfelt sigh of relief, pulling himself upward with rust-stained hands, Duncan climbed the last few steps and stood amid monstrous bearings, silent hydraulic motors, a maze of cables, much dismantled plumbing, and the delicate tracery of ribs supporting the now useless 100-meter parabola. There was still no sign of Carl, and Duncan began a cautious circumnavigation of the antenna mounting. The catwalk was about 2 meters wide, and the protective rail almost waist high, so there was no real danger. Nevertheless, he kept well away from the edge and avoided looking at the 50-meter drop. He had barely completed half a circuit when all hell broke loose. There was a sudden whir of motors, the low booming of great machineries on the move, and even the occasional accompaniment of protesting shrieks from gears and bearings that did not wish to be disturbed. On every side, the huge skyward-facing bowls were beginning to turn in unison, swinging around to the south. Only the one immediately overhead was motionless, like a blind eye no longer able to react to any stimulus. The din was quite astonishing, and continued for several minutes. Then it stopped as abruptly as it had started. Cyclops had located a new target for its scrutiny. "Hello, Duncan," said Carl in the sudden silence. "Welcome to Earth." He had emerged, while Duncan was distracted by the tumult, from a small cubicle on the underside of the parabola, and was now climbing down a somewhat precarious arrangement of hanging ladders. His descent looked particularly hazardous, because he was using only one hand. The other was firmly clutching a large notebook, and Duncan did not relax until Carl was safely on the platform a few meters away. He made no attempt to come closer, but stood looking at Duncan with a completely unfathomable expression, neither friendly nor hostile. Then there was one of those embarrassing pauses when neither party wishes to speak first, and as it dragged on interminably, Duncan became aware for the first time of an omnipresent faint hum from all around him. The Cyclops array was alive now, its hundreds of tracking motors working in precise synchronism. There was no perceptible movement of the great antennas, but they would now be creeping around at a fraction of a centimeter a second. The multiple facets of the Cyclops' eye, having fixed their gaze upon the stars, were now turning at the precise rate needed to counter the rotation of the Earth. How foolish, in this awesome shrine dedicated to the cosmos itself, for two grown men to behave like children, each trying to outface the other. Duncan had the dual advantage of surprise and a clear conscience. He would have nothing to lose by speaking first. He did not wish to take the initiative and perhaps antagonize Carl, so it was best to open with some innocuous triviality. No, not the weather. The amount of Terran conversation devoted to that was quite incredible, but something equally neutral. That was the hardest work I've done since I got here. I can't believe that people really climb mountains on this planet. Carl examined this brilliant gambit for possible booby traps. Then he shrugged his shoulders and replied, "Earth's tallest mountain is 200 times as high as this. People climb it every year." At least the ice was broken, and communication had been established. Duncan permitted himself a sigh of relief. At the same time, now that they were at close quarters, he was shocked by Carl's appearance. Some of that golden hair had turned to silver, and there was much less of it. In the years since they had last met, Carl seemed to have aged 10. There were crow's feet wrinkles of anxiety around his eyes, and his brow was now permanently furrowed. He also seemed to have shrunk considerably, and Earth's gravity could not be wholly to blame, for Duncan was even more vulnerable to that. On Titan, he had always had to look up to Carl. Now, as they stood face to face, their eyes were level. But Carl avoided his gaze and moved restlessly back and forth, firmly clutching the notebook he was still carrying. Presently, he walked to the very edge of the platform and leaned with almost ostentatious recklessness against the protective rail. "Don't do that," protested Duncan. "It makes me nervous." That, he suspected, was the purpose of the exercise. "Why should you care?" The brusque answer saddened Duncan beyond measure. He could only reply, "If you really don't know, it's too late for me to explain." "Well, I know this isn't a social visit. I suppose you've seen Kalindi." "Yes, I've seen her." "And what are you trying to do?" "I can't speak for Kalindi. She doesn't even know that I'm here." "What are the Mackenzies trying to do?" "For the good of Titan, of course." Duncan knew better than to argue. He did not even feel angry at the calculated provocation. "All I'm trying to do is to avoid a scandal, if it's not too late." "I don't know what you mean." "You know perfectly well. Who authorized your trip to Earth? Who's paying your expenses?" Duncan had expected Carl to show some signs of guilt, but he was mistaken. "I have friends here, and I don't recall that the Mackenzies worried too much about regulations. How did Malcolm get the first lunar orbital refueling contract?" "That was 100 years ago, when he was trying to get the Titan economy started. There's no excuse now for financial irregularities, especially for purely personal ends." This was, of course, a shot in the dark, but he appeared to have landed on some target. For the first time, Carl looked angry. "You don't know what you're talking about," he snapped back. One day, Titan, Cyclops, gently but firmly interrupted him. They had quite forgotten the slow tracking of the great antennas on every side, and were no longer even aware of the faint whirr of the hundreds of drive motors. Until a few seconds ago, the upper platform of 005 had been shielded by the inverted umbrella of the next bowl, but now its shadow was no longer falling upon them. The artificial eclipse was over, and they were blasted by the tropical sun. Duncan closed his eyes until his dark glasses had adjusted to the glare. When he opened them again, he was standing in a world divided sharply into night and day. Everything on one side was clearly visible, while in the shadow only a few centimeters away, he could see absolutely nothing. The contrast between light and darkness, exaggerated by his glasses, was so great that Duncan could almost imagine he was on the airless moon. It was also uncomfortably hot, especially for Titanians. "If you don't mind," said Duncan, still determined to be polite, "we'll move around to the shadow side." It would be just like Carl to refuse, either out of sheer stubbornness or to demonstrate his superiority. He was not even wearing dark glasses, though he was holding the notebook to shield his eyes. Rather to Duncan's surprise, Carl followed him meekly enough around the catwalk, into the welcome shade on the northern face of the tower. The utter banality of the interruption seemed to have put him off his stride. "I was saying," continued Duncan, when they had settled down again, "that I'm merely trying to avoid any unpleasantness that will embarrass both Earth and Titan. There's nothing personal in this, and I wish that someone else were doing it, believe me."